George Washington was more than ready for retirement. On the day he finally returned to Mount Vernon, his plantation on the Potomac River, he had been absent for almost a decade. And in the meantime, much had gone a-begging. The British had actually raided the area, and a British naval officer, who threatened to bombard Mount Vernon from the Potomac, had to be bought off by Washington's manager and cousin, Lund Washington, with barrels of flour and water and hams from the smokehouse. Washington sternly reproved his kinsman when he heard about this. He would have preferred putting a match to Mount Vernon himself rather than giving the British anything. But he wondered whether he had even the stamina necessary now to bring Mount Vernon back to productivity. Labor was so scarce that he hired German immigrant workmen to begin rebuilding the grounds. And he wrote to old acquaintances to ask for samples of seed and for a young bull. After an absence of almost 9 years and nearly a total suspension of all my private concerns, I am at length set down at home and am endeavoring to recover my business from the confusion. Nevertheless, as he admitted to the Marquis de Lafayette, whenever Washington recalled to mind the days of my youth, he found that they had long since fled to return no more, that I was now descending the hill I had been 52 years climbing, and that though I was blessed with a good constitution, I was of a short-lived family, and might soon expect to be entombed in the mansion of my fathers. Mount Vernon was not the only drain on Washington's energies. The American colonies, now the American states, had always been blessed with one great asset and two great debits. The asset was land. The debits were the shortage of labor to work the land and make it productive, and the lack of credit to buy more. As long as the colonies were colonies, Americans like Washington had ready access to British credit, and to British politicians who could smooth the way for land acquisition. Now, the British politicians were gone, and so was the access to British credit. Before the Revolution, Washington and his brothers had made substantial investments in land development schemes like the Ohio Company and the Mississippi Company. And after the Revolution, he became deeply involved in plans for the Potomac Navigation Company, which aimed to develop the Potomac River as a major artery of American commerce, and to link it through the construction of 5 canals along 190 miles with the Ohio River, and thus make the Potomac the chief commercial highway of the United States. This would also bind the Trans-Appalachian West more firmly to the East Coast states. No well-informed mind need be told, Washington warned, that the flanks and rear of the United Territory are possessed by other powers, and formidable ones too, nor how necessary it is to apply the cement of interest to bind all parts of it together by one indissoluble bond, particularly the middle states with the country immediately back of them. For what ties, let me ask, should we have upon those people, and how entirely unconnected should we be with them if the Spaniards on their right, or Great Britain on their left, instead of throwing stumbling blocks in their way as they do now, should invite their trade and seek alliances with them? The Potomac Company cost Washington a lengthy survey of the headwaters of the Potomac, and the equivalent of $1 million in modern currency. But the company would have to attract the equivalent of $40 million from investors if it were to succeed. And that kind of capital was not going to be forthcoming so long as foreign investors feared that reckless state legislatures would allow hard-pressed American borrowers easy relief from their obligations. Washington had none of Thomas Jefferson's distaste for commerce. I cannot avoid reflecting with pleasure on the probable influence that commerce may hereafter have on human manners and society in general, he told Lafayette in 1786. I indulge a fond, perhaps an enthusiastic idea, but the period is not very remote when the benefits of a liberal and free commerce will, pretty generally, succeed to the devastations and horrors of war. But not, of course, if the behavior of little state legislatures like Rhode Island, the demands of Shays' rebels, and the paralysis of the Confederation Congress prevented it. "My opinion is," he confided to another old revolutionary protege, Light Horse Harry Lee, "that there is more wickedness than ignorance in the conduct of the states. Or in other words, in the conduct of those who have too much influence in the government of them. And until the curtain is withdrawn and the private views and selfish principles upon which these men act are exposed to public notice, I have little hope of amendment without another convulsion." Investment capital was also not going to be forthcoming, so long as jurisdiction over the Potomac River itself lay between the two states which shared it as a boundary, Virginia and Maryland. Maryland's 17th century charter from King Charles I set Maryland's southern boundary as the far bank of the Potomac, effectively giving Maryland legal jurisdiction over the entire river. Washington was able to inveigle the Virginia legislature to commission four representatives, George Mason, Edmund Randolph, James Madison, and Alexander Henderson, to meet with a like number from the Maryland legislature, Samuel Chase, Thomas Johnson, Thomas Stone, and the oddly named Daniel of St. Thomas Jennifer, to iron out the legal difficulties. Two of the Virginia commissioners, Madison and Randolph, never received word of their appointment and missed the meeting entirely. And when the commissioners met in Alexandria in March of 1785, the Marylanders balked. They wanted Virginia to eliminate the tolls it was charging on shipping at the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay. They also wanted a renegotiation of fishing rights, and they wanted a sharing of costs for maintaining lighthouses. The Virginia commissioners had instructions to make no concessions about the tolls, and despite the most amicable dispositions and the greatest desire of forming a fair and liberal compact, the commissioners deadlocked. Finally, on March 24th, Washington himself intervened. Both delegations were invited to Mount Vernon, and once under Washington's roof, and with no difficulty in reading Washington's mind, the commissioners finally agreed that the Potomac should be declared a common highway, with the remission of the Virginia tolls and a variety of other concessions very important to the commerce of the two states. What was more important, however, was the recommendation George Mason made to the Virginia legislature in his report of March 28, 1785. That it may be proper for the two legislatures, at their annual meeting in the autumn, to appoint commissioners to meet and communicate the regulations of commerce and duties imposed by each state, and to confer on such subjects as may concern the commercial interests of both states. The Maryland legislature was only too happy to agree, since Maryland was very glad to get what she got by this compact, and not only appointed commissioners, but proposed inviting two other parties to Chesapeake navigation, Pennsylvania, and Delaware, to the meeting. The Virginia Assembly agreed and went one step further by proposing that the next meeting of the commissioners take into consideration the trade of the United States and consider how far a uniform system in their commercial regulations may be necessary to their common interest and permanent harmony. The man who offered that resolution to the Virginia Assembly was James Madison, who was supposed to be present at the Alexandria and Mount Vernon conferences, but who had never received word of his nomination in time. He was now prepared to make up for that guiltless oversight, for James Madison was about to become the prime mover, not only of the next Potomac River Conference, but of an entirely new governing document for the United States. James Madison's great-grandfather, John, had arrived in Virginia in the 17th century, laying claim to 600 acres on the York River that he had earned by sponsoring the passage of 11 indentured servants. Like the Jeffersons, the Madisons parlayed small public offices and advantageous marriages into the ownership of 4,675 acres in the Piedmont. And by the time James Madison was born in March 1751, the Madisons were the greatest landowners in King George County. In 1762, Madison was, like Thomas Jefferson, put in care of a clergyman schoolmaster, Donald Robertson, where he was put through the usual regimen of Latin and Greek in Horace, Ovid, Xenophon, and Homer. He was switched in 1767 to a more advanced school run by the Reverend Thomas Martin, which made for a very different experience indeed. The Madisons were conventional members of the Church of England. James Madison's cousin, also named James Madison, went on to become a bishop in the Protestant Episcopal Church, the post-revolutionary Americanized version of the Church of England, and president of William and Mary. But Thomas Martin was a graduate of the same college of New Jersey in Princeton, which had produced Alexander Hamilton's tutor. And he had been deeply influenced by the aggressive evangelical theology promoted by Princeton's early presidents, Aaron Burr, and the great Jonathan Edwards. So in 1769, Madison's father, James Sr., was persuaded to send his son, Jemmy, not like most of Virginia gentry's sons, to William and Mary, but to Princeton. Surprisingly, Jemmy Madison turned out to be perfectly pleased with my present situation as a first-year student at Princeton. But he did not drink deeply of evangelical piety. He solemnly agreed that a watchful eye must be kept on ourselves, lest while we are building ideal monuments of renown and bliss here, we neglect to have our names enrolled in the annals of heaven. Further than that, Madison never went. He never bothered seeking confirmation in the Episcopal Church, and many years later, when he was asked to recommend theological reading, he offered a grab bag of titles that ranged from deists to Church of England latitudinarians, people who did little more than recommend proofs for the existence of God from clues in the natural world, to Jonathan Edwards's evangelical Calvinist masterpieces, Freedom of the Will, and On the Nature of True Virtue. But at the same time, Madison was no intellectual wastrel. John Witherspoon, the dour Scots Presbyterian president of the college, recalled that during the whole time Madison was a student at Princeton, he never knew him to do or say an improper thing. Hamilton told Witherspoon that he wanted the freedom to take his degree as quickly as he could pass courses, only to be rebuffed. Madison asked for nothing, but managed to complete his courses in 2 years anyway, and spent a third year after his graduation in 1771 under Witherspoon's personal tutelage. And though John Witherspoon might have been a Presbyterian true blue, his reading lists for students like Madison embraced all the great names of the Enlightenment. Locke, Montesquieu, Hume, and the sharp literary style of Joseph Addison's celebrated magazine, The Spectator. One thing Princeton did not do for him was confer good health. Madison, at 5 feet 6 inches, was slight of build, and frequently described as feeble, pale, or sickly. And he himself believed that he suffered from a constitutional liability to sudden attacks somewhat resembling epilepsy. He went through the motions of reading law, although it seemed clear that, again like Jefferson, this would never serve as more than a personal adjunct to the far larger responsibility he would one day inherit from his father as a Virginia grandee. He was commissioned in 1775 as his father's deputy as a colonel in the county militia. But there is no evidence that his ill health ever permitted him to serve. It actually came as something of a surprise when, in 1776, he was initiated into his public career by a county election to the Convention of Virginia, which instructed the deputies of the state to propose a Declaration of Independence. 4 years in the Virginia legislature and on the Governor's Council of State in Williamsburg did nothing to impart gracefulness and ease to Madison's shyness. And the wife of one influential Virginia politician described him as the most unsociable creature in existence. But that experience did introduce Madison to Thomas Jefferson, with whom he formed a lifelong friendship. And in December 1779, just after Jefferson's election as governor of Virginia, Madison was appointed a member of Virginia's delegation to the Continental Congress. Madison did not land in Congress as a full-throated exponent of national authority. He was there to defend Virginia's interests. And he did this on three vital points. The first concerned the Mississippi River. Assuming, as one had to in 1780, that the United States would prevail in its revolution, Congress wanted it clearly understood that the United States' western boundary would inevitably have to be fixed at the Mississippi River. It was another question, however, whether Spain, which still ruled the Louisiana Territory and most of the western banks of the Mississippi, would open the river to American trade. Congress hesitated. The revolutionaries needed Spain as an ally, and some of the delegates were willing to trade navigation rights on the river for Spanish assistance against the British. Not Madison, though. If the American boundaries reached the Mississippi, so would Virginia's. And Madison stubbornly insisted that Congress had no business giving away Virginia's claims on the river's commerce. He was just as stubborn on a second issue, the call by Congress for Virginia to cede all its claims to Western territory in order to induce small states like Maryland to ratify the Articles of Confederation. He could not reconcile with the respect due from every state to its own sovereignty and honor an appeal from its decisions to a foreign tribunal, as though the Confederation Congress was as alien to Virginia as Parliament. Third, Madison resisted Congress's decision to recognize Vermont as an independent and 14th state, because Vermont had been carved out from lands originally claimed by New York. If the district in question was comprehended within the jurisdiction of one or more of the United States, Madison insisted, it must necessarily follow that the inhabitants could have no right to set up an independent state. But Madison soon enough learned, in the same way that so many other Americans had learned in the 1780s, that a Congress powerless to control the states made for a nation that no one abroad had confidence in. Something Madison learned to his sorrow when he made his first big investment in land with a small purchase, as he put it, of 900 acres in upstate New York. He would have gone for more, but for the difficulty of raising a sufficient sum, which restrained us from making a larger one. In other words, he had not been able to find lenders willing to finance his investment. And so he turned to Jefferson, who by then was serving as American representative in Paris, to see if French financiers could cough up, say, 4,000 or 5,000 louis. Well, Jefferson told him frankly that not even George Washington had been able to find lenders for the Potomac Company in Paris, due to the habitual protection of the debtor by state legislatures like Rhode Island's. Madison could hardly expect to do better than George Washington. Congress would have to take the lead First, by demonstrating that it had the power to pay off its own existing wartime loans. And the second, by showing that it could control the waywardness of the state legislatures in tax and money matters. Madison's solution, like others in Congress, was to support the granting to Congress of the power to levy tariffs, that 5% impost proposed in 1781, for starters. The idea of erecting our national independence on the ruins of public faith and national honor must be horrid to every mind which retained either honesty or pride. And the only remedy, said Madison, would be a plan of general revenue operating throughout the United States under the superintendence of Congress. All of this pleading was to no avail. And it left Madison covered with embarrassment when Virginia, which had originally ratified the impost, rescinded the ratification. He gave up the struggle in December 1783 and took up a seat in the Virginia legislature, fighting off proposals to pay state debts in paper money. He missed the Mount Vernon Conference, but he persuaded the Virginia Assembly to endorse George Mason's call for a larger conference, and got himself appointed as one of the commissioners to the upcoming meeting. A circular letter was sent to the other states, inviting them to appoint their own commissioners and to meet at Annapolis, Maryland, on the first Monday in September 1786. Madison was not exactly giddy with anticipation. He feared that the expedient is no doubt liable to objections and will probably miscarry. But I think, however, it is better than nothing, and as a recommendation of additional powers to Congress is within the purview of the commission, it may possibly lead to better consequences than at first occur. But he was not optimistic. His real hope, as he told Thomas Jefferson a month before the meeting, was that the Annapolis Convention would pave the way to a plenipotentiary convention for amending the Confederation as a whole. But, he added, I despair so much of its accomplishment at the present crisis that I do not extend my views beyond a commercial reform. To speak the truth, I almost despair even of this. And at first, Annapolis seemed to confirm Madison's direst fears. Although he understood that 8 states had pledged to send delegates, only 5 delegations actually showed up. New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, and Virginia, comprising only 12 commissioners. And Madison was almost minded to break up the meeting with a recommendation of another time and place and an intimation of the expediency of extending the plan to other defects of the Confederation. But among those 12 commissioners were precisely the individuals most capable of carrying the convention forward. Madison, to begin with, but also Alexander Hamilton from New York, and John Dickinson of Delaware, the architect of the original Articles of Confederation. And once they began deliberating, matters moved ahead handsomely, shifting swiftly from problems in regulating interstate commerce to the fundamental and essential principles of the Union. On the 4th day of the convention, the delegates adopted an address to their respective state legislatures, written largely by Hamilton. The address boldly announced that since the New Jersey delegates had been authorized by their state to do more than just talk trade and commerce, but to expand their purview to include any measures which would enable the United States effectually to provide for the exigencies of the Union, the delegates have been induced to think that the power of regulating trade is of such comprehensive extent and will enter so far into the general system of the federal government that to give it efficacy and to obviate questions and doubts concerning its precise nature and limits may require a correspondent adjustment of other parts of the federal system. May require. And without pausing, the address went on to specify just what mechanism the Confederation should adopt for putting itself out of business as a confederation. A convention of deputies from the different states to meet at Philadelphia on the second Monday in May next to take into consideration the situation of the United States, to devise such further provisions as shall appear to them necessary to render the Constitution of the federal government adequate to the exigencies of the Union, and to report such an act for that purpose to the United States in Congress assembled as when agreed to by them and afterwards confirmed by the legislatures of every state. This, they proposed, will effectually provide for the same. There had been motions in the Confederation Congress before of convening a National Assembly to reconstruct the Articles, some of them as early as 1784. 4 months before the Annapolis meeting, Charles Pinckney of South Carolina, on the floor of the Confederation Congress, urged that a grand committee be appointed to take into consideration the affairs of the nation, or perhaps even appoint a convention for that purpose. But this was becoming old stuff. Amendments to the Articles of Confederation were considered and then dropped. In New York, Governor George Clinton torpedoed another initiative by Congress to levy an impost by simply refusing to call the New York State Legislature into session to consider it. It would take pressure of a kind no one in the Confederation Congress had yet experienced to make a national convention possible. But in these circumstances, the pressure happened. By the time the Annapolis commissioners had returned home, they were greeted by the news of Daniel Shays' assault on the courthouse in Springfield, Massachusetts. Thereafter, things would move rapidly.